I would like to introduce Eva from South Pasadena, who will be our speaker tonight.
Hi everyone, I'm Eva.
Hello.
Holy moly. Trying to fix this. Thank you, David, for asking me to come out. David K, for asking me to come out and share my experience, strength, and hope. But I also want to thank David G, who'd asked me before twice, and twice I said, I'm not ready. I'm still not ready, but here I am. And I also want to thank my ladies who showed up for me tonight. Thank God you guys are here. I actually was hoping to fill up the whole room with just them, and then I could just be talking to them. So thank you for coming out to support me. I learned in Al-Anon that I didn't have to do anything by myself if I didn't want to, and this I did not want to do by myself. Okay, so I'm just gonna ask my higher power to help me share tonight and speak from my heart. I wanna tell you that I'm nervous, but instead I'm gonna tell you I'm really excited to be here. So excited. I like to keep it really simple and tell you what I was like, and then tell you what happened, and then tell you what I'm like today as a result of this program. I am a grateful member of Al-Anon, and I did come into this program because of a man, but I stayed for myself. And I'm really grateful that I got that message really early in my recovery. I grew up in a family that was absolutely affected by alcoholism. Nobody called it that, but that's what was happening. My mother drank a lot. Everybody drank a lot, but my mom drank a lot. And I found myself really fixated on her. She was my original higher power. So I was really tuned into her. Because of her, I'm not here to take her inventory, but because of her drinking and whatever she was doing, she really wasn't available to myself or my siblings to nurture and raise us, be a mother really of any kind. There was a lot of things that happened in that house that were not okay. I work for a government agency today, and I see some of those types of situations. We would probably, if that was happening today, would not be with our mother, would not continue to live with her. Mommy drank a lot. I'll share a couple of stories to kind of identify what the alcoholism was like in that home. One night my mother, her boyfriend, and her best friend were out celebrating his birthday, and she drank a lot. And the thing about my mother when she drank was that you just didn't know who you were going to get. It was kind of like alcoholic roulette. Was she going to be weepy? Was she going to be happy? Was she going to be angry? Was she going to be belligerent? And on this particular evening, I guess she chose belligerent. And she and her boyfriend got into an argument, and he struck her. So they came home arguing all the way. Her best friend mediated to the best of her ability. We don't know this, we're just at home, my brother and sister and I. And didn't think anything of it until sometime in the middle of the night you just heard like this arguing, this yelling. And by that time in our house, there was always yelling, always. It was just like the normal mode of communication. Except for this night, it was like this weird, hot, like just more intense. And so my brother, sister, and I woke up and looked out into the living room to see where they were and what was going on. And my mother had her boyfriend at knife point at the door. She had waited till he had gotten down to his boxers and a wife beater and then pulled out the knife and was threatening to kill him because he had hit her. And he was just trying to get out. So we raced out we're trying to calm her down. She was really upset and really drunk. And he was really afraid. We were all afraid. And the thought that was running through my mind was, if she kills him and goes to jail, how am I gonna take care of my brother and sister? it wasn't, it didn't, you know, like, that he was going to die. Like, it, all of that didn't matter. I was so concerned about how am I going to be responsible for these two other people and myself. Because that's who I had become in that environment, with my mom's drinking and her inability to really kind of provide any parental direction. I became the mom. So I had to, you know, those are the things I worried about. He eventually got out of the house, slept in the garage. We went to bed. The next day we got up, went to school, and nobody ever talked about that, ever. Like, we not even to each other. We never even said, hey, that was crazy last night, right? Nothing. So that was like a really scary story. Here's one that's a little more fun, but still kind of crazy. So my mom's boyfriend was a bartender, shocker. He was the guy who, like, his shift closed the bar. So on this particular evening, might help to mention I'm Mexican, he brought home, the mariachi showed up at the bar, they were having such a good time, this whole band, that he brought them home on a school night after the bar closed, and we woke up that night to a full-on mariachi band playing in our little house. It had to be after two, it was like middle of the night. And we got up and we saw it was a party, and we danced and we had such a great time. It didn't even faze you. Like, what's happening? It's the middle of the night. It was like, no, it's a party. Let's go. And that was a lot of fun. Again, I don't remember when we went to bed. I don't know how it ended. I know the next day we didn't talk about it again, but it wasn't a bad thing. It was just like that. And I didn't think anything of that. Those things were not abnormal to me. They were just what my life was like. However, after that party in the middle of the night in our little neighborhood, neighbors were asking me what the hell was happening in my house. And that was the first time that I thought, what's happening in my house is not what is happening in your house. And I felt that instant shame of, you know, something's wrong with us. I mean, for a long time I felt something was wrong with me, but now it's like all of us. And that's just what it was like. There was never any kind of verbal or physical affection. If you were touched in my home, it was usually of an abusive nature. My mother was volatile. She was a really scary person. And I, you know, again, she's my higher power, so my whole life is focused on her trying to find a way to make her happy. Because I thought if I could just find a way to make her happy, then we would all be safe and we would be okay. I will tell you, I never found out what that was to make her happy, but it didn't keep me from trying. I learned to live my life by the look in her eyes, is what I like to say. And so when I left that home as a young adult, I left with absolutely no life skills, but a ton of survival skills, right? I knew how to live in crisis. I knew how to handle when, I'm not going to curse, when stuff went down, but I had no clue on how to live life on life's terms. Right out of the gate, I will tell you that the boys that I was attracted to as a young girl and as an adult woman are still like those really cute, charismatic addict alcoholics. Out of the gate, like the first guy that I liked was drying pot on his grandma's roof. He was so cute. Just putting that stuff up on Nani's roof to dry it out. And I was, you know, that was it, I was hooked. You know, and after a little while, didn't date a whole lot, but but definitely there was a pattern in the people that I was dating. So I decided to take a little break. I was like 18 and already said, okay, I need a break. Then I met this really sweet kid from Indiana who wasn't like anybody else. He didn't have a drinking problem. He didn't really have any kind of drug problem. He was just this really nice kid from Indiana who smiled at strangers on the street. I'm from LA, I'm from the Barrio, we don't do that. And we just, you know, he had like a difficult upbringing. He had moved to LA from Indiana to be with his dad who, you know, who'd not been really present in his life. And so, you know, we were these two kind of hurting people that just kind of latched onto each other. And so we thought it would be a really good idea to move in together, get married, have some kids by the time we were 21 and he was 20. So I had we had our first son, we were married and had our first son when I was 21, had our daughter just shy of my 25th birthday, and by the time I was 28, I was getting a divorce. I had no idea how to be married, none whatsoever. I knew how to create crisis. I knew how to stir up drama. I constantly threatened divorce when he wasn't acting the way I wanted him to. Initially that worked and he would behave and fall in line, and then one day he said, you know, that sounds like a really good idea. So that's what I get. And so there, you know, but that's okay, because by then I had already met the him that was gonna, you know, that's the guy that's gonna fix it. Because it was just that it wasn't me, it was this guy. Like, he was too young and he didn't know, and I just needed a man. So I met somebody that I worked with, and we started out as friends. This is being recorded, I'm telling a whole bunch of people I don't even know. But it started as an affair, and it's never something I'm proud to share. But it is what happened, and I'm asking Alan on to be rigorously honest. So I'm being rigorously honest. We worked together, he was 18 years my senior, and we started having an affair that ended his marriage. Mine was already over, we had been separated, but I hadn't filed for divorce. So we both got divorced, and we were together for a period of time. He is the alcoholic that got me here. He'd been sober for about 11 years at that time. I'd already kind of understood I knew nothing about alcoholism, but I knew that there were, that I had issues around that. So I thought, well, he's sober and 11 years, so there's no problem, right? Like, it's all good, because I don't know. And so we dated for a couple years, and then we moved in together. And he'd wanted to get married, but I had already done that, and I did a really bad job of that, so I didn't want to do that again. I was afraid of making that mistake again. So what happened, because that brings us to what happened was that he went out after about 17 years in sobriety. And I didn't know that if he wasn't attending meetings and he wasn't working a program, that might happen. I just thought, he doesn't drink anymore, and I'd never seen him drunk, so it wasn't something that I thought about. I didn't know about Al-Anon. I didn't know that, despite the fact that even when he wasn't drinking, there was a lot of like the alcoholic dynamic that was happening. There's me in the picture, I'm clearly been affected, and then there's him. And so it was just a lot of chaos and a lot of drama. And so when he went out, I think for the first 3 years of that, I was in absolute denial of it. I thought, he's having another affair. I would like go through his pockets, through his briefcase, you know, I was doing all this stuff. I had never done things like that before, and I was all up in his stuff, trying to figure out what's going on. And I think on some level I understood it was drinking, and I didn't want to admit that. I think I knew if he's drinking, this is done, because there's what he shared with me about what his drinking life had been like. He was, you know, what do they say in AA? He was a serious alcoholic. That guy was a serious alcoholic. So after a few years, it was, yeah, a few years, because I'm a, because nothing gets by me. it became obvious that he was drinking. And then, you know, what happened to me while that was going on was I devolved. I like turned back into that little girl living in her mother's house again. And I was fear driven. I was anxious. I was insecure. I was just obsessed with this person and trying to find a way to figure out first what was going on and then how to get him sober. And so one of the things that happened was he actually got arrested, and I didn't know about it, because what he did when his drinking really started to get going was that he would disappear. He would drink, he would go out after work and go drinking and then not come home. And so, you know, first it was just overnight, and then it was a couple of days. He's the guy that would say, I'm gonna go out for a pack of cigarettes, and then show up 3 days later. Or get his dry cleaning, or whatever it was, the excuse for going out the door, and then I didn't know when he was going to come back. I took that really personally, by the way, initially. I felt like he doesn't love me enough to come home, and it must be something wrong with me. I didn't think that it was just that he needed to go drink, right? It wasn't about me at all. But I'm self-obsessed, right? And a lot of the characteristics that I hear men and women in AA share, I also share, except for the, I have no desire to drink behind them. I just think behind them. So he would be gone for days, and I would just be a mess. So to talk about like my obsessive or my compulsive behavior, if I started calling him and he didn't answer his phone, I could not stop calling. I literally could not stop calling. I think he said one night I called him over 90 times. It was obsessive. In my defense, if he'd picked up the phone, I would have stopped. Like, that makes so much sense to me. Like, pick up the phone. And then whenever he did, I would just say, like, are you okay? I mean, it was so lame. You know, I was a person that would pace around and watch windows. I would listen for the sound of his car. And then as soon as I heard it, I'd climb into bed and pretend to be sleeping because I didn't want him to know that it was bugging me that much that he wasn't home. Like, I didn't want him to know that it mattered to me that much, but it did. So the circumstances of my bottom are this, right? That's what was going on for a number of years. We were living like that. I was falling apart. It was really hard for, I mean, I was completely falling apart. I remember driving my kid to karate and bursting into tears, and I didn't even know why. I just, you know, and I thought, I'm like, I've got to step out, and I'd weep. I would just cry. I was so just distraught and felt so hopeless. So the circumstances of my bottom are this. It was his birthday. Did I mention I'm a manipulator? I'm a manipulator. And so I set about like constructing all this like really nice stuff to do for him for his birthday because I'm loving like that. And so, you know, coffee in bed, I brought him his coffee, and then, you know, he'd been losing all this weight because on top of the drinking so he could drink longer, he was doing other extracurricular stuff. So he's losing weight. I noticed that, so I'm like, let me get you a healthy smoothie because it's your birthday and I love you and you're going to quit drinking if I'm nice. At least that's what I thought, right? It really is what I thought. And then, you know, there were birthday cards. I sent him flowers to work. Manly flowers. I think there were sunflowers in it. I don't know. But I thought, yeah, I'm gonna like, so like he knows that I love him, right? And made dinner, and he didn't come home. So I started calling, and he did answer, and he said he was having hanging out with his friends at Mijares. You guys know where that's at, local, yeah. Right? Because we lived right here in South Pass. So he was just having a just hanging out with some friends, and what was wrong with that? It was his birthday. I said, all right. So in the trash goes his dinner. The birthday cards we got him, I tore them all up. I don't remember what I got for a gift, but like everything, the cake was trash, it was my way of letting him know I'm mad. Like, you are such an ingrate after all I've done for you. Hold on, the salute. So that when he did come home, he was quite intoxicated. And Winnie Eddie used to say that her mouth was connected to the doorknob so that as soon as the doorknob turned, it just started going. I had that kind of a night, right? Like, so he came home and he sees the car, and I wanna see that he sees. I wanna, like, yeah, that's how you get, that's what you get. And he was so drunk and he got so mad. And he said, go to your room. I'm a grown-ass woman. So I put my hands on my hips, and soy Latina, so my neck starts going. I could not help it. It just started doing that. And then he lunged at me, and I got scared. And then he grabbed me. He just grabbed me by my head. He never struck me. I just was like totally clear. He never struck me, but he held me and he wouldn't let me go. And I kept trying to pull away. So three times I asked him to let me go. And at this point I am definitely in the fight or flight kind of thing. And I just want to leave. Like I'm gonna go to my room. Suddenly I'm quite compliant, right? And he wouldn't let me go. And he was saying something to me through gritted teeth. I really couldn't say exactly what he was saying other than I was just, you know, it was something to let me know that he was really mad and I was just so scared. So I couldn't fly. I did tell you, soy del barrio, you take the girl out of the barrio, you're not taking the barrio out the girl. And we just started, I just started throwing blows. Like I literally just started fighting for my life, I felt. Like I didn't know what he was gonna do and I just started to swing. I broke his glasses on his face, so he's bleeding from his face. We fall to the ground. My son and my daughter were in bed, but my son, who was 15 at the time, I did mention he was in karate, right? He's now a black belt and teaches. But he walked out with a samurai sword because he heard all this commotion. And he walked out with the sword. He said he saw me on top, looked like I was winning, put the sword away. He was drunk off his ass, guys. Hey, I'm available. Anybody want a date tonight? But then he came. But my son put the sword away and came up, and I'm on top of him, and I'm just trying to get up, and I look up, and I look up into my son's face, his eyes into my eyes. And I was raised with that kind of violence. That was the norm for me. It was not the norm for my children. And I had promised, I'd made all these promises about how I was not gonna be my mother, I was not gonna have this violence in our home, I was not going to live the life that, have them live the life that I had lived. It was gonna be different for us. And here I was in a physical altercation with my boyfriend, and my son has witnessed it. And I was incredibly, I was just so much shame in that moment, like just washed over me. I told my son it was okay to go to his room. He stands up, he's mad, he's threatening to call the police. I would have gone to jail, because if the police had come, you know, domestic violence, domestic abuse is domestic, it doesn't matter who's perpetrating it. He was the one bleeding. And thank God he didn't, but he left. And I don't know what possessed me other than I didn't want him to leave and I asked him not to leave. And he was done, so he, don't leave, and he's out the door, which was the best thing he could have done. My son came back and talked to me and said, I never want to see something like that again. And I promised him he would not. And in that moment, that particular circumstance, which was the bottom for me because I couldn't believe I was there. I'm a smart girl. Like, I did a lot of stuff to like change my life from what it looked like it was supposed to be to what I wanted. And here I was in the environment that I had grown up in. In fact, I grew up with my younger brother and sister, and I was calling my children at that time by my brother and sister's name all the time because I was that little girl one more time and they were my brother and sister. And we were back in that alcoholic environment and I felt so helpless. It wasn't the powerlessness that we talk about here. It was this helplessness and this hopelessness of not knowing how to make this better. But in that moment, I did that prayer that we hear about, right? That one that just said, God, help me. And I hadn't been talking to God in a long time. I had always been drawn to a creator, a God, something other than myself. But as my life unfolded the way it did when I was a child, I just felt like that God didn't care about me and my family. So I just stopped talking to that God. And then plus I felt like I had done a lot of really not good things, like have an affair with a married man. So I felt like God was GPS, and if I prayed, he would see where I was. I didn't need him to know where I was. I was hiding out. But that night I said, help me. And within a couple of weeks, I was in an Al-Anon meeting. I was at the Saturday night Marengo meeting. It's no longer there, but that's where I went. And there were like five women in the meeting. What I remember one of them saying was that she had 22 years in the program and she felt like a newcomer. And I remember thinking, I do not want to be here 22 years. But then right behind that thought, and I know that this was my God, was I don't have to have this all sorted out right away. Like, I can be here a while. That's not the way I thought, so I know that that's God. So I don't remember much other than that, but I knew that it was something. There was something there. So I went back the next week, and I felt better. For like an hour and a half, I felt better. That's the hope that we talk about in this program. So I don't know exactly what was shared, but I know what was communicated was hope. And I had become really isolated by that point. I'd stopped talking to the people in my life about what was happening because they were watching it, and they all kept saying, just leave, and I couldn't. I don't know why, but I could not leave that situation. I couldn't leave that man. I couldn't leave that situation. I had tried, but I wasn't able to. And by then, I just felt a lot of shame about where I was, and so I just stopped talking to people. You know, we heard about it tonight, the isolation. And that's where I was. I was really isolated. I was absolutely despondent. And so Al-Anon, what it provided in those first couple of meetings was hope. I had some prior engagement on the following Saturday, so I opted to try a different meeting. So you guys have lots of meetings here. So I went to one that's now my home group, the Thursday night South Pasadena at 7:45. And I knew when I walked in that that's where I was going to keep coming back, that that had a different feel. There was so much recovery in that room. And I heard like laughter. I mean, people were laughing about things that I was crying about, but it made me feel like hopeful. I heard women in particular sharing about situations that didn't look that different than mine, and yet they were sharing their experience and their hope and the tools that they were using. So what I heard was keep coming back, which I did, get a sponsor, which I did, work the steps, okay, get into service. And I was really lucky. My home group had a really good group of gals that were doing a lot of service above the group level. So I got involved with alathons and roundups and conventions right away. They just took me under their wing. By the way, I just want to say this. I am not a joiner. I desperately want to belong, but I never want to join. And that I was really reticent. Like, I just kind of towed in. I didn't, and Al-Anon is so gentle. It just, really the only thing he said was to keep coming back. So I didn't have to do any of that other stuff. It was just suggested. But because I saw women and their lives getting better, it inspired me to do what they were doing. So I started working the steps with my sponsor. I'm still living with that alcoholic. I'm there for, you know, like a year. Everything on the outside looks exactly the same. I am with the same person. I'm still with that alcoholic. Same two kids. Same job, same car, same dog, same everything, and yet I am different. Something is going on inside of me that's different. And continued to work the steps and got to this place with my sponsor where I realized that this person, this man who I loved, who was not seeking any kind of sobriety. By then he'd gotten arrested and had to go to AA meetings. I thought that was God. Like, yeah, he's got to go. I thought like he'll step over the magic threshold of AA and get sober immediately, struck sober. That's not what happened. He didn't want it. And so, you know, the stuff with him just kept getting crazier. And one night he showed up, he had crashed his car, left it wherever he crashed it, was bleeding from his scalp, completely intoxicated, obviously not calling the police or anyone because he was drunk. Luckily, no one else got hurt. When they towed the car to our place the next day, I thought, what are you waiting for? What are you waiting for? Like, he's gonna kill somebody or himself. Why are you still here? So when I talked to my sponsor, I said, you know, I need him to get sober if I'm gonna stay. Can I tell him that? Because I didn't know what it was okay to say or not say, right? I'd been controlling and manipulating my whole life, and I don't know how to just communicate and not expect that outcome. Just how do I ask? And she just said, you can ask that, but he may not do it. So I did ask that. I know that he meant it with, you know, in that moment that he would try, but you know, alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And that's the path that he took. So I left. I took my two kids and left, and just stayed in program. I had friends asking me, are you still going to go to those meetings? And by then I knew, I'm here because of me. So yes, I'm going to keep coming. And what happened was, you know, by that time I was, like I said, really estranged from my family. I wasn't really speaking to my mother anymore. And we'd always had a very difficult relationship, and it had just gotten to the point where I wasn't communicating with her. I one day was in a grocery store in her neighborhood, and she was in the dairy section, and my first instinct, I had a grocery cart full of groceries, and my first instinct was to run out of the store, because my mom was in the store. And it had been about 5 months since I'd spoken to her. And instead, you know, Al-Anon was working in my life. I walked up to her, and she burst into tears. And I realized that I was punishing her, and had been punishing her my whole life, for not being the mother that I thought I deserved, and the mother she should have been, in my opinion, right? And I started to work on that relationship. I heard Carl, I don't know if he's here tonight, but Carl talked about letting it begin with me. He came to my home group meeting and shared and spoke, and he shared about let it begin with me, and I thought, well, you know, maybe I can try that. Maybe I can just call my mom once a week and see what that looks like. And we, you know, I started to repair that relationship. It's a realistic relationship. It's not kumbaya, you guys. Like, it's not like we, you know, skipped along happily, because we're still who we are. But I was able to make direct amends to her, which I was sure when I got here and I was new and we were doing step study meetings at my group, and they asked, I was talking about step 8, and I said, you know, well, I know one person who will never go on that list, and I said it was my mother, and she was one of the first people I made amends to, because by the time I got there, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. So really quick to kind of bring it up to date, because I'm almost out of time already. the last few years for me have been like another bottom in recovery. I can tell you that I got a little complacent with my program. I mean, I still attend 3 to 4 meetings a week. I sponsor a gang of women. I have a sponsor. I work my steps. But, you know, things were going all right. Like, I'm with a new guy. He's sober. It's all good. Like, the kids are growing, and now they've moved out. And I, you know, my character defects are what they are. I'm self-righteous. I'm smug. I'm arrogant. I think I got this thing on lock. And my longtime partner runs off with a girl half my age. And he's super public about it, like social media, all over it. And we have a ton of mutual friends and family and on these various sites. And I would walk into a meeting and know that people in that meeting would see what he was doing. And I'd have to, like, I felt so much humiliation over that. But what I would do was, like, I'd square my shoulders, I'd take a deep breath and say I didn't do anything wrong, and I would walk into a meeting and hold my chin up. And everybody was just really loving and understanding, and they knew, you know, I mean, that was his deal. And I had to work through that. I was devastated by that, you guys, because I didn't see it coming. And so I was absolutely devastated. And in that devastation, I reached out to God again, and this time what I got was I forgot to love myself. I made loving him and him loving me more important than loving myself. So I started to work on that. And the other thing I got to practice and work on was forgiving. Not that I wanted to do that, but when I got still and I got quiet, that's the message I got, was you gotta forgive him, you gotta forgive her, and you gotta forgive yourself. So I spent, like, I did a 40-day meditation every day meditating to forgive him, because it's not a one and done thing. It's, you know, it's just like the steps. I have to keep doing them if I wanna keep benefiting from them. And so I had to keep forgiving. I had to keep loving myself, and that's how I was going to get free of that pain and of that hurt that I was experiencing because of something he needed to do for himself. It had nothing to do with me, right? It had nothing to do with me. When he came back and I took back, I was really glad I did the forgiveness, and then it didn't work out well because, you know, he has a pattern. But, you know, I got to walk away with dignity the next time. I got to tell him, this isn't working. And you know, he begged for another chance, and I just, you know, it was like, I totally know the fear that you're going through, and it's gonna be okay. Because I would have wanted him to do that for me as opposed to walking out. I would have wanted him to like talk to me. And so I got to treat him with compassion, and we both got to keep our, I mean, I expect that we both got to keep our dignity. I don't talk to this person anymore, but I only wish him well. If you love somebody, for me, if I've ever loved somebody, I don't stop loving you. I just don't ever need to talk to you again. I am such a grateful member. I want to say happy birthday to all the birthday people. I'm so humbled by everything that you shared. And Mike, I think I was here that night, Michael, that night that that stuff went down in 2008. I was in this room and I was like, holy moly. Wow, somebody needs Alan on. I'm just so grateful that I get to be a member of this program, that there's always hope, and that all I have to do is put one hand in God's and one's in Alan on, and I'll be all right. Thanks for letting me share today.
Thank you.